So last week, we finished the 10th chapter, which showed us the divine glories of the Lord called Vibhuti Yoga. When the student asked the Lord, as we know, the Bhagavad Gita is taught by the Lord himself, Lord Shri Krishna, to the student Arjuna, who is learning from the teacher. And he asked the Lord that you tell me that you are everywhere and you are all pervading, formless, because in the 7th, 8th, and ninth chapter, he talks about this essence of the Upanishads, that there is one consciousness that is all pervading, that is there everywhere, in all the beings, in all the plants, animals, and even in the inanimate objects, even in space between us and her and him. The Lord is there between us. He is within and outside us. He is in me talking at this moment. He is in you listening. But the student says, it is hard for me to fathom you as this all-pervading. How am I to meditate upon you? How am I to think about you? And if you say, oh, I'm thinking of this all-pervading. For an advanced meditator, yes, he can think of God as this life principle within me that is, you know, expressing and all that. But for most of us, we like to have a beautiful form of the Lord. That's why we have Jesus on the cross. We have Krishna playing the flute, Shiva sitting in meditation, Mother Saraswati playing the veena. So all these beautiful forms make it easier for us to contemplate upon God with a form. But they say that you should not restrict yourself just to that form. That don't say, okay, God is only in Jesus or he's only there in Krishna. But he's there everywhere. As all the forms, all these divine forms are his. All the humans are his expression. All the animals, all the birds. That's why saints who have discovered their oneness with God then develop universal love, which you and I find it very difficult because we love in a person who belongs to my community or my race or my country or my church or my religion, but a saint develops love for all. And so the student asked the teacher, tell me where I can see you so that it should be easy for me to find you. And we know God is everywhere. That is true. But then he says, is there any specific place I can find you? Like we know, the U.S. government, where does it extend from? Extends from sea to shining sea, you know, from the Pacific Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean. Everywhere is the U.S. government. But if I want to contact the U.S. government or I want to find them, where do I go? I go to Washington, D.C. and I go to the Department of Defense or the Department of Education or the Department of Health, wherever I have the business, and I put in my application and I deal with them. If I want to deal with the California government is in Bakersfield, is in Fresno, is in LA, but no, you have to go to Sacramento, go to the Capitol building, go to the governor's office. So there are specific places where you can contact. Like if you want to contact the federal government in Bakersfield, okay, you go to the federal. There is a federal building where there is a federal office. So similarly, he says, Lord, I know you are everywhere, but where can I find you? Like Lord is everywhere, but when you go to a church or a temple or a mosque and you sit there in silence, you feel the Lord's presence much better. As opposed to you go to a nightclub where people are drinking and there is loud music and even there a wise person can see the Lord's presence, but it becomes more difficult. But when there is silence, when there is quietness, then you feel, lot of peace. So in the 10th chapter, the Lord tells Arjuna that I am everywhere, but if you want to remember me, then he gives 54 specific examples. That wherever you see anything beautiful, glorious, wonderful, you can see my presence. And that is true when you see a musician playing beautiful music, somebody doing a beautiful dance, an Olympic gymnast, you know, performing on those little bars. Whenever you see anything, a beautiful piece of poetry, and a scientist coming up with the new ideas, that's where you see the Lord. And that's what he says. And then he gives him examples like among the mountains, I am Mount Everest. Among the birds, I am the eagle. Among the animals, I am the lion. It's not that I am not there in all the animals, but the most glorious of all the animals is the lion. Among the subjects, I am the king or I am the president. So, by giving these examples, what he says is that when you see something beautiful, then you remember the Lord. And that is the idea that among all the rivers, I am the Ganges River because that is considered holy. So among all the waters, I am the ocean. Why? Because the ocean is vast and all the waters, you know, merge into the ocean and then the rain emerges. So through these examples, you are able to remind yourself of the Lord. Like when you see a little baby smiling, or when you see a flower blooming with that perfume, then you say, who is the one in all these beautiful colors? When you see all these fish with the beautiful colors and all the peacock, you know, with all its beautiful feathers, only a great artist could have done that. So that is the idea, that the more often you remember the Lord, the more often your heart becomes pure, it gets purified. That's what they say. Remembering and chanting the Lord's name is like a detergent. Just as when you put detergent, you put Tide, and then you run your clothes, they come out fresh and white. So similarly, chanting the Lord's name and remembering the Lord, and doesn't matter what name, doesn't matter what form, doesn't matter what book, what church, what temple, what building, what prophet, it doesn't matter. But if you remember that Lord, whether you remember him as form and formless, whether you remember him as the life in me or as the life in all, or as the murti in the temple, however you remember me, the Lord says, I purify your heart, I make your mind pure. In fact, in the Thursday evening, those who are coming to the Thursday evening classes, we are going to start a text called Manashodhanam. In about 2 or 3 weeks, which is Manashodhana, means purity of mind. So how do you purify your mind? That is, we'll be doing on Thursday evening, 6:30 to 7:30. I'm quite excited because that's a very, very beautiful text written by our the head of the mission, Swami Tejomayanandaji. He has written that text, and that will be starting Thursday evening shortly. So in the 11th chapter, which I shall introduce, which we are starting today, the 11th chapter is a practical demonstration. Like when you have heard something in a theory textbook, and then you want a practical demonstration, like the teacher will tell in the physics class, he will say, you know, what is water? Water is H2 plus O, two molecules of hydrogen, one molecule of oxygen. And the students will laugh. What are you talking? You know, this is a liquid. How can two gases, hydrogen and oxygen, be combined and made into a liquid? I think teacher has lost his mind. You know, so students will start giggling. And the teacher knows that. So what he will do, he'll say, okay, that's fine. You don't believe me? Okay, put a little, you know, a beaker of water horizontal. Then he'll put two electrodes, an anode and a cathode. The anode is the positive and the cathode is the negative. And then what he will do, he will run an electrical current. So the oxygen will start migrating towards the one, and then the hydrogen towards the negative, and the oxygen towards the positive. And when the current is strong enough, the water will actually split. And you will see the hydrogen bubbles rising in one and the oxygen bubbles. And when he collects them in the beaker, then he can show that this same water, which was liquid, was able to be split into two gases just by putting the right kind of current. So what they have studied in the books has now been demonstrated in the laboratory for the students. So similarly, the student here asks the teacher, okay, you told me that everything is in you and you are in everything, but I want to see it. Okay, I believe you, but I want to get a practical demonstration. Show it to me. If you think you are there, I want to see it. And that's a challenge. You know, you're sitting in front of the Lord and sitting in front of the teacher and saying, I don't believe what you're saying. I want to see it for myself. Only a student who has a very pure heart and a pure mind and that kind of daring to challenge the teacher. And that's one of the things in the Vedas or in the Vedanta, in the Upanishads, the student has the right to challenge the teacher. He has the right to question the teacher. Nowhere it says, I said it, you have to believe it. If you don't believe me, you will go to hell. If you believe me, you will go to heaven. None of that. It is, I have said it. If you like it, take it. If you don't like it, you're fine. And if you don't agree or if you have a question, please feel free to ask. And so that is the beauty of this, especially the Bhagavad Gita, which is a question and answer format. And so here the answers are given by the teacher in response to the student's questions. And many places in the Gita, the student says, I don't think what you're saying is practical. In the sixth chapter, he says, what you have told me, yat tvaya prokta Madhusudana, even though you're saying it is very good, I don't believe it. I don't think it is practical. So the teacher has to answer the student's doubts. So the 11th chapter starts with a question by the student. And I'd like to give you a little bit stage of how this battle is happening and what is happening. The battle was between the Pandavas and the Kauravas. The Pandavas were the good and the Kauravas were the evil. They were the corrupt, they were the dishonest, and they had stolen the kingdom from the good cousins, and they were ruling, and the people were very miserable. And so the idea was that the good people should rule, and so there was a battle between the good and the evil. And Arjuna was the best warrior of the Pandavas, and they needed him because without him they would never have won the war. And Krishna was Arjuna's charioteer. Here we can see the chariot, and Arjuna has come down, but in the battle, Krishna, the Lord, actually was his driver, was his chauffeur, and drove him all over the place. And what happened in the beginning of the first chapter, Arjuna got worried. Not so much he was afraid, but he thought that this war is going to cause so much destruction, and why should I fight the war just to get a little kingdom? And then the entire Bhagavad Gita was given to show him that it's not only a battle for a small kingdom, but it is a battle for the future of India. Because do you want India to be ruled by the good people or by the evil? Because if people are evil, then obviously the subjects will be evil, and there will be corruption and there will be cheating. But if the good people are ruling, then the country will be good. So he is giving this message. And then in the palace, what happened was the Kaurava's father, Dhritarashtra, was blind. He was born blind. He was the king. And his sons, of course, were running the kingdom, even though he was the king. He himself was not evil, but he was very weak. And his evil children had taken over and were running the kingdom. So he's sitting in his palace. And he does not know what is happening in the war. He's obviously concerned because his children are fighting against their cousins. So he had a minister called Sanjay, who was his advisor. And Sanjay was a very divine person, but had been employed by the evil king. So he couldn't obviously, take sides. And he had been given Divya Drishti. It's called a divine vision, where sitting in the palace, he could see what was happening in the battlefield, even though the battlefield was several miles away. Not only he could see, but he could go into the heart of the people and know what they are thinking. That was the special vision given to him by Vedvyas, who was a great sage, who actually wrote the Mahabharata and wrote the Vedas. And organize the Vedas. So this Sanjay had this special power called Divya Drishti, with which he was telling the old king what is happening in the battlefield. So this was like a running commentary. It's like when we cannot watch a football game, we are not at the game, but the commentator is there and he's watching the game, and then he's telling us, okay, the quarterback has the ball and then he threw it 5 yards, and then they show it to you on TV. Or if you're listening on the radio where you can't even see it on TV, then you have to rely on the commentator, especially in India, when the cricket matches are going on, people are all the time glued to the radios listening to the commentary. I remember all these great Vijay Merchant and all these commentators. They could bring the game right to your house, the way they would describe it, even though you were not watching, but their ability to explain. And here also we find some commentators like John Madden and all. When they describe the football game, it's like you are actually there. So this commentator could actually describe what was happening. So then the first verse, I don't know whether we want to do each verse in detail. I think because this chapter does not have too much commentary. It is mostly a description of the Lord's glories. So either I can just summarize the chapter or we can chant the verse and go in brief. I don't know what people would feel like. What do they want to do? But just chant the verses. You want to chant. Okay, yeah, we can chant the verses and then I'll just talk about each verse in brief. And hopefully in the next 2 or 3 months, we can finish this chapter. Not that this chapter is not important. I don't mean that. I mean, in fact, it is one of the most beautiful chapters because when you close your eyes and you imagine that scene, you can actually see that the Lord's glory in this chapter if you read it in detail. And also, I would recommend everybody to have those green books if you can just raise it up. Because in the green book, Swami Chinmayananda has done a word-by-word commentary and also translated and interpreted it for us. So whatever I speak is given in that book and in a lot of detail. So when you listen here, then you can go home and read in that. And what that does is it will strengthen the knowledge and the understanding. And a lot of people actually, like Barbara, she reads beforehand, before she comes. So that way she's prepared for her questions. That's why I'm always afraid of her questions. No, I'm just joking. It's nice that you do that. But that's good. You know, the best way is to read before you come so you know what verses are being done. And then also when after we are done, go back and read it again. So that way the knowledge becomes firm. It becomes pakka. And so that is very good. So we'll start with the 11th chapter, the first verse. अथ एकादशोऽध्यायः विश्वरूपदर्शनयोगः अर्जुन उवाच मदनुग्रहाय परमम् गुह्यमध्यात्मसंज्ञितम् यत्वयोक्तं वचस्तेन मोहोऽयं विगतो मम. Before we start what I have spoken so far, does anybody have any questions or comments on what we just heard or what we just said? Anything you have any doubts or anything you agree or disagree with? So we can, I can take a minute and, yes.
Maybe my question is that Sanjay ended up being a good person, but he was just commenting on the fact.
Yes.
But he wasn't advising him because it wasn't that
good. Right. I mean, subtly he was trying to tell the king, which you will see in his comments, where he tries to show that the Pandavas have the Lord on their side. The Lord is on the side of the good and your children will lose. And so even though he couldn't directly tell him, because he would have been hanged or he would have been fired from his, because his job was to be an impartial commentator, but now and then you can see where his sympathies lie or where, you know, he's subtly telling the king. But you see, he was employed. He was being paid a salary. He couldn't really go against the king, you know. So, yeah, but no, he didn't directly advise the king. No, other people did, but the king was blind. Not only he was physically blind, he was mentally blind. He was so blinded by attachment for his children that no matter what they are doing, they are right. And that's what happens to us when we get blindly attached to our children. Even the child may be doing wrong and the other child may be right, but when there is a conflict, we always take our child's side. So that is wrong attachment clouds your judgment. Yes.
Like you said, God is in the most beautiful things. So there is God there in the not so beautiful things and not so beautiful creatures as well?
Yes, God is everywhere. God is everywhere. We are not saying he's not. But certain places, it is easier to feel his presence. Like when we are sitting here and we are talking, when you're talking about God, it's like you can feel his presence, you know, in a company or in a... But if you're, like I said, if you're in a crowd that is yelling and screaming and throwing and there is a fight going on, it is hard to see the Lord's presence in there. So Lord is there everywhere, but it is easy to see him in the beautiful things. But he's there in the ugly things too. And that's why one has to develop universal love. And if somebody is not that good, then it is our job to help that person. Somebody is unhappy, somebody is suffering. So if I have extra, then I should share with that person because that is the Lord. And I am helping myself because it is one everywhere that is one. So when you help with that attitude, then you are that I'm serving the Lord who is also in me. So the Lord in me is serving the Lord in. So there is only one. Yeah. No, definitely. Yeah, we should see him in all. But Arjuna had asked him for specific examples. And so the idea being that, like when I turn the light on, you know, in my house, I always think, you know, where this electricity, where did it come from? You know, the energy comes from him. When you see the sun rise in the morning, or when you see the beautiful moon, or when you see, you know, beautiful valley, or you see the mountains, when you're driving on the grapevine and you see the, you know, the flowers. So it is easier to remember him, but he's there everywhere. He's also there in the gutters, you know, where the dirty water is running. So God is everywhere, but it becomes easier to, and the idea is to remember him as often as possible. If you can remember him in the ugly, that's good. Remember him there too. Right. What she says is Dhritarashtra was blind, not only physically, but he was mentally blind too. He didn't have the right judgment. He didn't have the right vision. He was favoring his children even though they were wrong. And because of his false judgment, his children also to some extent turned out evil. Because if the father doesn't discipline the children or the mother doesn't tell them what is right, then, and if you let them do whatever they want, then they will turn out to be not as good children. So part of parenting is to discipline the children and tell them what is right. And he failed in his duties because he was so blinded with attachment. And that's what happened. That's part of the secret of good parenting, that to know when to love the child and when to, you know, to discipline. Does not mean that you have to physically beat them or abuse them, but giving them right advice and then following it through, you know, that if you don't do this, then this will happen. So then the children respect authority and they respect discipline and they want that, because the children are at that age of their 8, 9, 10. Like people, some of them come and say, you know, my child doesn't want to come to Bal Vihar. And I said, your child is only 7. What does he know? What is good for him or not? Like if tomorrow he says, I don't want to go to school, you're not going to let him not go. So we know what is good for the child. And that is why we have to, certain things you have to put down and say, okay, this is good for you. You have to do it. Not as a dictator, but as through love, and you know, that you know that what is right for the child. And so being able to instill right values in your children through love and discipline is very important. One has to combine the two. And he failed in that, and that's what she said. Thank you. So in the first verse, he says, Madanu Grahaya Paramam. He says, you are extremely compassionate to me, O Lord. And that is what one has to see, that the Lord is a compassionate, loving entity. You know, some people say father, some people say loving mother. You know, that's fine. You can love God as a father, you can love God as a mother, you can love God as a friend, as a beloved. You know, many people love God as a beloved, like Mirabai or some of the nuns in the church. They say, I'm married to Jesus. Or Mirabai said, you know, Mere to Giridhar Gopal Dusra na koi, I'm married to Krishna. So you can love God in whatever form, but one has to remember that he is a compassionate, loving personality who loves us and who has given us whatever we have out of love and compassion. So he says, you are extremely compassionate. That's why you have told me this secret. This secret knowledge. Knowledge that does not mean secret, does not mean that should not be given. But for Arjuna, that was a secret. Like something I don't know, like Russian, for me is a secret. Why? Because I don't know it. But English, I can speak. So English is something that is known to me. Like Spanish, I couldn't speak earlier and then I learned. So it was a secret, but now I know some. So what you don't know, if someone comes and tells you, then you say, oh yeah, this was a secret to me, but I was told. So he says, I have been told by you. And because of that, moho ayam vigato mama, my delusion has been gone. Because in the beginning of the first chapter, Arjuna was very deluded. He did not know what is his duty. He did not know what he is supposed to do. And the entire Bhagavad Gita is a message to him and to us, because we are also often confused about our duty, about our what I should do, what I should not do. So these scriptures, whether it's the Gita or the Bible or the Guru Granth Sahib or whatever the scriptures are means to remove our ignorance. So he says, listening to you, my ignorance is completely gone. Vigato mama, completely gone. Second verse. Bhavapyayo hi bhutanam shruto vistarasho maya tvatta kamala patraksha mahatmyam api chavyayam. So bhava apyayo, so the birth and death of bhutanam, of all the beings, I have heard from you. He has used the passive shruta vistarasho maya. In detail, I have heard from you, O Lord, how the beings are created, you know, through all this chapter, how they are sustained, how they are destroyed. Everything I have heard from you. You told me about how the world started and where it started, and then who is the one that is sustaining everything? It is the Lord. And also when we die, then we merge back into that reality. Just as a pot is created out of mud, is sustained by mud. And then when the pot breaks, it gets destroyed, it goes back into the mud. So I have heard from you in detail how the world was created. And O lotus-eyed one, Kamala Patraksha, the one who is very beautiful, has beautiful lotus eyes. He says, I have heard about your glory, Mahatmyam api chavyayam, your unending glory, how glorious the Lord is, how wonderful you are, how beautiful you are, how much, you know, you do and what, I mean, to think about it, you know, this world we think is trillions of miles, is a very small part of the Lord's glory. He extends way beyond that, you know, way beyond the heavens, way beyond the hells. I mean, it's unending. There is no end to that. And how glorious you are. I have heard of that, but I want to see it. I have heard it, now I want to see it. And that is the demand of the student, that of the devotee. He says, I want to see your form. I just don't want to hear it. So it is a beautiful verse. We'll talk about the next verse, verse number 3. Evametad yathatvam Atmanam Parameshwara Drashtum Icchami Te Rupam Aishwaram Purushottama. So he has used some adjectives for the Lord. He calls him Purushottama, the Uttama Purush, the highest reality. Then he says Parameshwara, the highest Lord. So he is respectfully addressing the Lord. He is not being disrespectful, even though he is asking him to show. But he is asking in a very polite way. He says, this I have heard from you, what you have told me. But drashtum icchami, I wish to see the te rupam. I wish to see your form. Because God is everywhere. But how am I to see? He says, it's like the mud is in all the pots. Okay, that you know. When you see a pot, you know mud. But to see the mud, not only in all the pots, but all the past, present and future pots, anything the pots that will emerge will all be that mud. And to see them all in one place is not easy. To see that, to visualize, like you can say, okay, all beings are in the Lord. But all beings in the past, present, and future, and everything that has come, will come, everything is the Lord. So Swami Chinmayananda says that one has to have a trick of dissolving space and time. Space and time are two factors which are responsible for creation. To create, the Lord needed space and time. Even in the Dakshinamurti Stotram, it says that Maya Kalpit Desha Kala Kalna Vaichitrya Chitri Kritam. Maya Kalpit Desha Kala Kalna. The Maya, the creative power of the Lord, used Desh and Kal, time and space, to create this glorious, beautiful world. Now, space is what separates it. But suppose space is removed, then what will happen? Suppose there is no space between anybody. Then we'll all collapse into one mass, right? Like Swamiji in his commentary says, like there is a toy maker who takes a ball of wax, beautiful big ball of wax. And then he makes these tiny little, you know, toy elephant, a wax camel, a little child, a flower, all these beautiful little cow, in all these beautiful little toys, and he has displayed them in his shop for sale. And then he realizes, you know, this is okay, but if I make God's figures, you know, if I make Jesus, and if I make Krishna, and if I make Buddha, then maybe I'll make more money. You know, these forms are not selling, nobody's buying. So what he does, he crushes, takes all the wax forms, breaks them and puts them back into one ball. Now, when he has removed the space, see, there was a space between the cow and the elephant and the camel. He removed the space and crushed them into one ball. And in that ball, you can still see the tail of the cow, and then you can see the little neck of the camel, and then the little foot of the baby in that big ball, because they have all been put together. So space has been removed. Once space has removed, then it all becomes one entity, one being, one. So what separates us from each other is the space. But when you remove space, the concept of space, you don't have to physically remove space. But if you remove the concept of space, then there is only oneness. Then there is no separateness. So that is what is the divine Divya Drishti, or the divine vision, is to remove that separateness. Because what separates me from others is the feeling that I am different. But when you remove that concept of space, then you see that there is only one. There is only one entity. There is no separateness. Then America is not separate from India. It's not separate from Mars. It's not separate from Jupiter. There is all one. You know, that is all oneness. And that is the concept of space. And also the concept of time. That the past, present, and future, everything is happening in that one entity. So when you remove those two, and that's what the teacher did, we'll see that in the next verse, in the fifth verse, that removed space and removed time. He says, I wish to see your form. Rashtum Ichchami. It's like a demand. But then he right away realizes, you know, whom am I speaking to? I'm speaking to the Lord of the universe. How can I demand of him? You know, he immediately realizes that he has made a mistake. So then his fourth verse is a little humble. He says in the fourth verse, Manyase yadi tat chakyam, Maya drashtumiti prabho, Yogeshwara tato me tvam, Darshayatmanam avyayam. So he calls him Prabho. He calls him, O Lord. You know, O Lord of the universe, Yogeshwara, the Lord of all the sciences. If you think, Manyase yadi tat chakyam maya drashtum. O Lord, if you think I am capable, then you please show me. First, his was a demand, and then he says, no. Because, see, there are two things. One is, that does he deserve? Like if I say, tell, oh, Krishna, I want to see your glorious form. It's not going to happen because I do not have that purity of mind like Arjuna. I do not have that spiritual evolution that he had. So, A, whether he is spiritually evolved, and secondly, whether his eyes can see it. Because as you will see in the fifth verse, what the teacher did was in the form of Krishna, in that one little form of 6 feet tall and say or whatever, 1.5 feet wide, he showed him the entire universe, all the planets and all the stars and even the heavens and the hells, and not only that, but even the past, present and future. He could see what is going to happen in the future and what has happened in the past. He could see it live. It's like a movie. And in that movie, not only he was seeing what has happened, what is happening and what will happen in the future, everything was shown to him. So it's a very glorious chapter when you read it with devotion and with love. It's a wonderful, the way it has been described by Ved Vyasji, it's a marvelous composition of poetry. That's what Gurudev says, that this is the best poetry you can hear because it's beautiful language. He has, and especially if you can understand Sanskrit, which I little bit I can, then you even appreciate it even more. So he says, if you think that I am capable of absorbing that, also one should be physically capable of absorbing that vision, you know, whether I can see it or not, whether I can understand it or not, am I deserving? It's like a second grade student. He comes to a physics professor and he asks some question, and then the physics professor says, you know what, to answer this question, you need to know quantum physics. And then he starts teaching him the principles of quantum physics to a second grade student, and he'll quickly run away. So the person has to be qualified. So that is what he says. If you think I am qualified, if you think I am deserving, then please show me your glorious form. We'll take a short break. Any questions? Yes. Well, it's like the ocean. Now, ocean is compassionate to the waves. Ocean created the waves, right? If you forget about the moon and the tides and all, but the ocean out of love creates the waves, right? And then sends the waves on. If you think like that, the ocean is the creator, ocean is the Lord. Now, ocean out of love creates the waves and sends them. Okay, now you go and enjoy yourself. And the waves go down, 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 and they're having a great time, you know, going up and down and this, you know, all that. So the ocean has created the waves. Now they are the ocean's children out of love. But when the wave ends and dies, does the ocean start crying? Oh, my dear wave, my daughter wave has died. No. The ocean knows that the waves will be created, will be there and will die. And then more waves will come. And constantly more and more waves are being created. The ocean, at the depth of the ocean, does anything happen to the ocean? Whether the wave has risen, and then some waves, you know, they'll say, like the wave will write his autobiography. I was a small little wave and I just started my journey. And then I gobbled up all the other waves and I became the most powerful wave and a huge wave. And I was so powerful, I could push boats aside and I ran over the surfers. And so many surfers were, you know, taken over by me. And then as I was going, then suddenly I realized, no, my God, I'm dying, I'm dying. And then the wave starts dying and starts crying when he writes his autobiography. The wave will become happy and unhappy when the wave is being born and dying. But does anything happen to the ocean at the depths? Ocean remains the same. Whether the wave is born, sustained or dying, the ocean remains unaffected. But the ocean creates the waves out of love. But itself is not involved in the birth and death of the wave. Because it knows that what is born will die. And then there'll be a time when you'll be going up and there'll be a time when you go down. What goes up must come down. You know, they always say that. So it is not involved in the day-to-day activities of the wave. Right? The ocean. So similarly, the Lord is the creator. And out of infinite love, he has given us this ability, beautiful eyes to see, and this mouth to taste, and these ears to hear, and the intellect, the intelligence to think, and the mind to feel all the beautiful emotions. So whatever I have in my body, my mind, and my intellect has been given to him, given by the Lord, to me out of love. But then when a human being is born and he's working, and then when it's time for him to die, if the Lord starts crying, then, you know, there are some people being born and some people dying, and some people are doing good and some people are doing bad, and some people are... And the good and bad is not the Lord who is doing it. It is our own karmas. You know, we have talked about that. So he remains unaffected by whatever is happening. He has created the world. He has given it, the human beings, the ability to think. And then depending on your intellect, you make good and bad choices and you get good and bad results. But he is dispassionate. He is not involved in the day-to-day, because he cannot be happy, sorrow, happy, unhappy. No, he's not. He is the creator. He is loving. He is compassionate. But he is not, he's dispassionate. He does not get involved. Like the mud, whether the pot is created or the pot is destroyed, the mud remains mud. Nothing happens to the mud. You can say the mud is dispassionate. Or the gold, you know, from the gold you make the ornaments and then you melt the ornaments and you make another ornament. Does anything happen to the gold? No, gold is dispassionate. The mud is dispassionate. The ocean is dispassionate. So that is why the Lord is described as dispassionate. That is one of his qualities. No, it's true. He is. It is true. He is. Because in fact, if once you go on the spiritual path and once you tune your mind towards that entity, you can call it God, then you see his hand everywhere. It becomes very easy to see him. It's very easy. All you have to do is, they say, na, divya drishti. You just have to develop that vision to see him working through every aspect. Everything that is happening, it's happening because of his love, his compassion. And, you know, that's true. You should ask him. But I believe more than it is in God's plan, I believe that you will get if you deserve it. You ask God, yes, but if you deserve it, you will get it. If you don't deserve it, say a child hasn't studied, you know, didn't study at all for his, and then suddenly in the finals he goes to church, oh God, make sure I get an A+. He's not going to get it. He's going to get an F. Why? Because he never studied. While another student who studied hard did very good, but he was nervous because he wasn't sure if he's going to do well. So he goes to the church again and prays for strength. Oh Lord, yes, I have studied, but I am very nervous. Please give me the strength so I may answer my questions well. So God will give him that strength. Because he has gone and asked and he deserves it, he will do well in the exams. But a guy who has not studied at all, he may go and pray. He may get a little peace of mind, but he suddenly, the questions are not going to, answers are not going to come miraculously in his mind. So you ask him, but he will give you if you deserve it, if you have put in the right effort. Because the karma comes, there's Lord's grace is there, but there is also your own karmas. If you don't do anything and you sit down and say, God, give me money, it's not going to happen. Like there's a story about this man, you know, who used to, every you know, month the lottery would come out. He'll say, he would pray, God, let me win the lottery, let me win the lottery. And the results would come out. Oh gosh, I haven't won the lottery again. Every month. And then one day finally went to the temple. He said, God, I have been praying to you for 5 years and I still have not won the lottery. What kind of God you are? So the voice comes from above. He says, son, meet me halfway. At least go buy a ticket. He hasn't even bought a ticket and he wants to. So God says, at least buy a ticket. Then I can give you that. So like, at least we have to buy the ticket to deserve it. Yeah, so that is the idea. No, he does feel sorry though. If you are suffering, even though it's because of your own actions, he will send somebody to relieve your suffering. If you, suppose I'm sick or my child is sick or something bad is happening, if you pray and if you have enough faith, even some means will come to relieve you of your suffering. And again, we have found that in the lives of great saints, when they sat down and prayed, the Lord came. And he has come repeatedly. And if you have faith, and there is a lot of power in prayer. It's not that God is sitting there like a judge in the court, you know, Supreme Court judge. They cannot have compassion because they have to strictly enforce the law. You broke the law, you get 14 years. There's very little room for wiggle for them. But the Lord has the ability to forgive us our sins and our problems if we pray with enough. But then we also have to have faith, have to have a, you know, thing that I made a mistake, accept that and all that, humility and all that. But yeah, no, there is a lot of compassion. It's not, even though they describe Brahman as this dispassionate, it's dispassionate as far as not being affected by it. But there is a lot of compassion. It's a very loving God. It's not a God that is here to punish us or to, you know, throw lightning or, you know, not, it's not that. Love is a very powerful force. If you want to reach him, you have to love him. Without love, you will never reach anywhere. Unless you love basketball, you're not going to become a great basketball player. Unless you love physics, you're not going to become an Einstein or a Galileo. Unless you love cooking, you won't become a good cook. So similarly, you have to love him to reach him. Love is a very powerful force. Thank you. Good questions. Thank you. Very nicely she says that whenever anything sorrowful happens, you know, we always blame him and criticize him. Oh God, why did you do it? Why did you do it? But we have to realize that whenever, even if there is some sorrow, there is a lesson behind it. There is some higher purpose for me to become a better person. It's like a mother, you know, when she slaps the child or when she, you know, punishes the child. It is out of love. When she hits the child or yells at the child, it hurts her more than it hurts the child, but she does it out of goodness that this child will benefit from it. So when the Lord is even giving us some sorrow, instead of complaining about it, one has to look that there is some better purpose. I'm supposed to become a better individual. And so when you look at that and you don't lose your faith and don't lose your love, then automatically your attitude becomes positive. And even that sorrow, you're able to go through it much better. Any problems you have, if you don't lose your faith in God, don't forget him, he will give you the strength and the courage, and he will send somebody to solve that problem for you. So he's full of love and compassion. The problem is we don't turn towards him. That's the ninth chapter. The ninth chapter is called The Royal Secret in Raja Guhyam. So as I said, secret does not mean that it's not supposed to be told to anybody, but it was, like I said, a secret is what I don't know. What I don't know to me is a secret, like I don't know quantum mechanics. So that is a secret, but for a physicist, that is very well known. So the 7th, 8th and 9th chapters are filled with the highest knowledge from the Upanishads. And Arjuna remembers that this knowledge, which to me was a secret, that's why Swami Chinmayananda was criticized in his life when he first started teaching in the 1950s, the founder of this mission. He used to speak in English. He was one of the first. Vivekananda was one from Ramakrishna Mission, and then he was the next who spread this knowledge in English. And when he started preaching it to the masses, going from one town to another and thousands of people would attend, there were some establishment pundits or priests who felt that this knowledge should only be taught in Sanskrit, should only be taught to Brahmins, should only be taught to few people, and it should be kept because that was a way of power. You know, like somebody who knows Latin and Greek will say Bible should only be published in Latin so that the masses should not know. They should come to me to learn the Bible. But when the Bible is published in English and distributed, anybody can read it. So that was Swami Chinmayananda's idea, that this knowledge is too valuable to keep it only in the temples. And so he started preaching, and he was criticized for that this is not this knowledge that should be spread, and it should not be taught in English because it's a foreign language. You know, so all those things, so that it should be kept secret. So this is a misinterpretation. What they mean secret means what I don't know. But the way the pundits interpreted that this is a secret knowledge, only few of us should have it, not everybody else. So, 9 is the essence of the Upanishads. Well, what it is that again it talks about this, that they are in me, I am not in them. Like the 9th chapter, it says that this whole universe is in me, but I am not in it. Like we talked about the ocean, then all the waves are in me, but I am not. So this whole that his compassionate and the dispassionate nature is all explained. Also how the universe came about, and also that this universe is a dream. You know, all those ideas are in the. Yes. That's why I think you have listened to 7th, 8th, and 9th. I did spend a lot of time. We did 2 verses every week. Actually, the 9th and 10th chapters, Tony has put online. You can listen to them again. We started in somewhere in the 9th chapter, I think. Yeah, they might in rebirth. Yeah, but in this particular birth, you were condemned. You were not qualified to study the scriptures. That's a way of keeping control. You know, it's like nowadays also we find that in business or in the, you know, if your father is a rich businessman, then, you know, he will give you the money. But if you are poor, you can't come up. Or sometimes people have a monopoly, like in the show business, especially in India. Unless you are a director's son or an actor's son, you can never come up, you know. We find all these Kapoors and all these, you know, Jitendra's children and, you know, all of these, all of the actors' children are becoming. Nobody else is given an opportunity to come. So that was the idea, to keep the power. And then again, the Kshatriya's children, like only the king's children, Kshatriya's could learn the art of warfare. You know, the others were not taught. So the idea was to keep the power in a few people, whether it's knowledge or whether it's, you know, power. Let's now say what the Lord answers. The Lord now, what he says. Verse number 5. Shri Bhagavan Uvacha. Pashya me partha rupani. Shatashota sahasrashah. Nana vidhani divyani. Nana varna kriti nicha. So pashya me, O Partha, O Arjuna, he tells him, pashya, see my form, my variety of forms. And interestingly, in this particular, the way they describe that in that 6 feet, or whatever Arjuna, Krishna's height was, and 1 foot or 1.5 feet width, in that area, Arjuna could see the entire universe, all the moon and the stars and the planets and the heavens and the earth and the hell and all the creatures and the past, present and future, everything he could see in that form. He says, Pashya me part, see my various forms, thousands, shata shota sahasrasha, thousands of, he could see thousands of beings in that one form. I mean, it was amazing how he could see that. Actually, Krishna had this ability. There's a story, I'm sure the Indians know. When his mother, when he was a little child, he was probably a few months old, he used to love to eat mud. He would crawl around and be eating the mud. And his mother used to slap him or, you know, get angry with him because he used to eat mud. So one time he was crawling around and his mother says, "Did you eat mud?" He shook his head, you know, he couldn't speak. So he says, "Open your mouth." And she yells at him. And he opens his mouth, and in his mouth, his mother saw the whole universe. He had this ability, the entire universe. And she saw all the planets and all the worlds. And she saw herself and her son in that mouth too. So she saw herself, the child Krishna, and the whole universe. And she was wonderstruck, what am I seeing? But then Krishna didn't want his mother to remember that. Because he said, if she remembers, then she'll treat me as God. I want her to love me like a child. He had taken birth to experience a mother's love. Because he says a mother's love is a very unique thing. So he made her forget that. Because he said, I want her to love me like a mother, not worship me like God. You know, Krishna didn't want that. So he had that ability. He has, in various places, he has performed these, you know, miracles to do that. So here he says, you can see the hundreds and thousands of forms, nana vidhani divyani, all different kinds, and nana varnakriti, and different colors and different forms and different shapes and different appearances you can see. Pashya dityan vasun rudran ashvinau marutastatha bahunyadrishta purvani pashyascharyani bharata. And now he says, you not only will see the things on earth, but you will see the heavenly beings that normally humans cannot see. You can only see after you die. But you can see Adityas, the children of Aditi. Aditi was the mother of all the goddess gods. Like even the Greek mythology, they have the mother, I forget her name now. But all the gods have taken birth, Zeus and Mercury and all of them have taken birth from that. So Aditi is the mother, all the gods, and their children. You see the Vasus. Vasus are the seasons. You know, there are gods that control the various seasons. There is a god for spring and summer and rain and, you know, all that. And then Rudras. Rudras are the destructive gods. You know, so why do you need gods of destruction? Because you do. Because unless you destroy, there is no room for new. Like the flower has to be destroyed for the fruit to be born. The fruit has to be destroyed for the seed to come out. The seed in the ground has to be destroyed for a new tree to come. So the whole universe is creation and destruction. Like the older people have to leave to make room for younger generations. Otherwise this world will become overcrowded. The dinosaurs had to go for the humanity to survive. So that's why they say you need the destructive god also. Ashvinav. Ashvinav are the dawn and dusk, the morning and night, representing the change of time. And then Marutas. Marutas are the gods of the wind. You know that the different winds, they say, are also controlled by celestial powers. Bahun adrishta purvani pashyas charyani bharata. And you will see various wondrous forms. Ascharya. Ascharya means, oh my God, I'm surprised. So surprising things you will see in my form that you have never seen before. Not only you have never seen, nobody has seen before. So that, as you will see later on, what kind of glorious things are seen in that form of the Lord. That is the... So this chapter has to be approached with some degree of devotion and reverence. Then you will enjoy, like when I was learning this chapter, and I also memorized it. It's one of the hardest chapters to memorize. It's 55 verses. But when I was memorizing, I was trying to visualize that there is the Krishna there, and in his form there is this and there is that. And when you do it with that, then this chapter fills you with wonder and ascharya and beauty. And it's a very nice, very, very beautiful chapter. But there's not much teaching in this. I mean, I'm trying to put, you know, wherever I can, some messages, but mostly it is a description of the form. Om sarve bhavantu sukhinaha, sarve santu niramayaha, sarve bhadrani pasyantu, ma kaschid dukha bhavet. Om shanti shanti shanti. Hari Om Shri Gurubhyo Namah. Hari Om.